Well, as you're probably aware, we're continuing tonight our study of Ecclesiastes, and this is the second address in the series. Tonight, Brother Paul is going to talk to us about limited time, human vanity increased by oppression. And that study is to be taken from chapter 3, verse 1 through to 4 and 16. Now, to introduce what he has to say, he's asked that we read chapter 3. So I will do that, Ecclesiastes chapter 3. So, with that introduction, we ask Brother Paul Southgate to address us on second in the series from Ecclesiastes, Limited Time, Human Vanity Increased by Oppression. Brother Paul.
Thank you, Mitch. Well, good evening to you all. One of the many differences between the human and the divine is the concept of time. We mortal humans see everything through the prism of limited time, whereas the everlasting Almighty is literally timeless. Indeed, time is one of the most precious commodities that we humans possess. Once time has passed, be it a minute, an hour, a year, or indeed someone's whole life, it has gone forever and can never be recreated. Such are the constraints that a finite lifespan of 70 or 80 years or so puts upon humanity. But not so with God, who knows no boundaries on his time. To him there is no difference between 1,000 years or a single day. And it seems from this passage that God can slow down or speed up time as he chooses, and indeed perhaps even somehow revisit the past in a way that we cannot understand. God cannot run out of time in the sense that we do. Yet, at the same time, he has a purpose, which is effectively a sequence of events that is unfolding to a fixed timetable. He has determined his plan and purpose, and it will come to pass exactly as and when planned at the pre-appointed times. Chapter 3, in verse 14 that we just read, "I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it, and nothing taken from it. God does it that men should fear before him." And that's a thought that we will come back to later on. But the plans of us mere mortals are subject to uncertainty, delay, and frustration. And what I think Solomon is trying to convey in these opening verses of chapter 3 is the need for men and women to use our time appropriately. Different situations will call for different behaviours. Essentially, mankind's actions are not constrained just by his physical environment or the people around him, but this abstract concept of time hems him in to an even greater degree. And so it is within this framework of time, says Solomon, that we have to make our life choices. But we should not think of time as something that we have no control over at all, as this would make much of the teaching of Ecclesiastes meaningless. But rather, Solomon is counselling his readers to use their discretion and experience to make the best possible use of their time and the opportunity that life throws at them. The expression carpe diem, seize the day, comes to mind in this context. This is expressed in the short poem in chapter 3, verses 2 to 8, a series of phrases in balanced opposites, rhyming couplets, rhyming in ideas and contrasts rather than verse, all of which, of course, should be bracketed by the phrases "a time to be born" and "a time to die," which sums up what we said at the beginning: humankind has limited time at their disposal. So Solomon asks in verse 9, What profit has the worker from that in which he labours? He suggests that we can never hope to cheat time and come away with a profit on the time span that is our own life. The best outcome is therefore, as we said, to optimise the use of time, whatever we have, and the choices that life presents us. Verse 10, I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. And this thought here echoes Solomon's self-appointed commission described in chapter 1 and verse 10. I think I might have the wrong reference. Maybe it's chapter 2 and verse 10. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. For my heart rejoiced in all my labour, and this was my reward from all my labour. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had done, and on the labour in which I had toiled, and indeed all was vanity. And grasping for the wind, there was no profit under the sun. Sorry, I don't think I have the right verse there. I think it was chapter 1 and verse 13. I'm sorry, I had a typo there in my notes. Chapter 1 and verse 13. And I set my heart to seek out and search wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This grievous task God has given to the sons of man by which they may be exercised. But in this chapter 3, the work described in verse 10 is not qualified by the word evil or grievous as in chapter 1. So why is this? Well, we note that in chapter 3, the task is God-given rather than self-given in chapter 1. And the first sentence of the next verse, 11, says, God has made everything beautiful in its time. So therefore, what might appear evil from mankind's point of view cannot be so viewed when one appreciates that it is ordered so by God. And this reminds us of God's verdict on his creation. God saw everything he had made, and behold, it was very good. And it also, of course, brings us to consider that whatever God has ordained is within his sovereign will, and therefore has a purpose. Even if it appears evil at the time, the ultimate purpose is to bring about God's kingdom on this earth, and therefore it must be good. The second sentence of this verse 11 gives the hint that there is more to human life after all than the finite time he is given in this mortal life. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from the beginning to end. Yes, at the same time, here is a paradox. God introduces the idea of eternity to man, yet he does not have the capacity to fully survey God's purpose from beginning to end. To do that, man would need to soar like an eagle over history. Yet in actual fact, he is more like a worm, earthbound, and as we would say today, unable to see the bigger picture. He can only see what concerns him immediately, both in time and space. And while that full vision is denied him, mankind cannot satisfy his deepest inner need. For there is now, for now at least, an inner conflict between his inner aspiration and the constraints that mortality brings. Yes, people, even if they don't have the truth, they don't understand God's purpose, yet they want to, or they would like to live forever, wouldn't they? They would like their works and their deeds done in this mortal life to live on forever. That can, of course, be expressed sometimes in very arrogant ways. But sometimes people like to leave a legacy by their life's work or their literature that they've written or paintings that they have created, things like that, or research and inventions that they've made. And in a sense, I suppose, people from the past who are still known to us today through their previous works do have some sense of eternity. even though, of course, they themselves have long since passed from the scene and no longer have any conscious appreciation of what goes on. This frustration and tension brings Solon back to his recommendation of the simple life, as set out in verses 12 and 13. I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labour. It is the gift of God. And so it is. A peaceful life with contentment is indeed a gift that God can bestow upon mankind. Being content with what we have, enjoying life, enjoying the food and the drink that God has provided for us. But of course, that is not the end of the matter. And Solomon does not stop there and accept this finite Arcadian vision as an end in itself. Rather, it leads him back to his thoughts of eternity in verse 14. I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. In fact, that what God does shall be forever leads to two consequences outlined in the second sentence of this verse. The first is that when dealing with God, man has to accept his reality manifested in the scriptures. He cannot add or take away from God's purpose. He can't pick and choose which bits of the scriptures to focus on, what bits of God's commands to listen to and what bits to ignore. He has to accept the entirety or not at all. God's will is sovereign, and so humanity should recognize such with the awe and reverence due to his name and respect all of his commands. And this is not to be done in a fatalistic way. Rather, it is acknowledging that those who would approach God must adapt themselves to his divine principles and to willingly and joyfully accept his instruction. Verse 15 is yet another way of expressing God's view of time that we looked at earlier, that one day is 1,000 years and 1,000 years is one day. Verse 15, that which is has already been, and what is to be has already been. What these expressions are really telling us is that God acts outside the limits of time that, as we saw at the beginning, so constrain human endeavour. From man's point of view, things pass along the spectrum of time and then pass into history, while the future is yet unknown. But not so for God, who is like the eagle that we mentioned earlier, who can see the whole progression of time from beginning to end, both in the past and into the future. This leads Solomon's thoughts to a truth that one day God will bring an end to the current order. The last sentence of verse 15, and God will requires an account of what is past. If time is like a river that flows orderly along, it is logical to suppose that one day it will reach a natural end, just as a river eventually empties itself into the sea. This climax will be reached when God requires an accounting of the events that have taken place in the past. And Solomon's thoughts mirror those of the Apostle Paul, who some 1,000 or so years later spoke to the Athenians about this very matter. We recall how Paul stated that God had always been overseeing human affairs, always aware of them, even though there had been times when mankind had been ignorant of him. But nonetheless, God always had an end point in view when he would judge the world in righteousness through his Son. And once that Son had been revealed, God invited all peoples to repent and turn to him, as they now became accountable to God through the preaching of the gospel. But before that end point in time, as we know it, is reached, Solomon turns his thoughts in verse 16 to the imperfection of judgment as practiced under the sun, which, of course, as we, I'm sure, all are aware, is a euphemism for the human rather than the divine sphere. He's disillusioned by the wickedness that he sees in the very place where justice should be administered. Moreover, I saw under the sun, in the place of judgment, wickedness was there, and in the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. Yes, how little has changed down the millennia, brothers and sisters. For today we see the same kind of corruption of justice that Solomon so lamented. But returning to the concept of a final reckoning at the end of time, in verse 17, Solomon has a spontaneous thought expressed in the words, I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there shall be a time there for every purpose and for every work. There will come a time when the judges are themselves judged. That time is, of course, today. God has appointed to judge the world in righteousness, when the human rulers of the nations throughout the ages and at that very moment in time will be found wanting and replaced with the government of his son, as was shown to King Nebuchadnezzar in his dream. And so God's judgment to be carried out through Jesus will be shown to be far superior to that of man's. God's judgment, incorruptible, completely accurate, completely fair, in contrast to man's corruptible, unreliable and biased, often biased judgment. The conclusion in verse 17 that Solomon makes from the human experience reviewed above is that God is putting men to the test in order that they may come to a realization of their own true nature. That is, that it's the same as the animals. I said in my heart, concerning the estate of the sons of men, God tests them, that they may see that they themselves are like beasts. The conditions of life under the sun, with all its frustrations and meaninglessness, should bring home to mankind how they share with the beasts a common life and a common death. For all their superior potential and intellect, humans cannot alter the fact that they have any more a superior destiny than animals. Verse 19. For what happens to the sons of men also happens to the beasts. One thing befalls them. As one dies, so dies the other. Surely they have one breath. Man has no advantage over beasts, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and all return to the dust. The writer surely had Genesis chapter 3, verse 19 in mind. In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you shall return. And this, of course, reminds us that the source of this vanity and meaninglessness that Solomon is talking about throughout the whole book of Ecclesiastes lies not so much with God, but with the choices that mankind made in the Garden of Eden, the consequences of which are still with us to this very day. The following verse, 21, could appear, if taken in isolation at least, to suggest a separate fate for people and animals. Who knows the spirit of the sons of men which goes upward, and the spirit of the beast which goes down to the earth? Yes, this could be taken as hinting of the existence of an immortal spirit. But it is best to read the verse as an ironic question, implying a negative answer. Other versions say, who knows whether the spirit of the sons of men goes upward, and the spirit of the beasts which goes down to the earth. In other words, Solomon is saying, no. As stated in the verses above, man is equally as mortal as the animals. Both live ultimately futile lives that decay into dust upon death. This is a universal truth. Even in Solomon's day, of course, there would have been much belief in the nations around, and perhaps even permeated Israel. The tradition, the false belief that man had an immortal soul that went to heaven at death. Course is a very, very old doctrine, far older than apostate Christianity. This has merely borrowed it from pagan religions. Solomon allows, indeed, for no exceptions in this passage, in contrast to the author of Psalm 49, who expresses a similar thought, but says, "Man who is in honour, yet does not understand, is like the beasts that perish." But the psalmist also says that God will redeem my soul from the power of the grave. And as an aside, I'd submit that Psalm 49 is probably a better verse to quote our friends who may believe in the immortality of the soul than this one in Ecclesiastes. The redemption of the just through faith is added by God's grace. Even the righteous have no automatic right or entitlement to immortality, and God's gift cannot alter the natural state of mortality and vanity that Solomon is explaining here. Indeed, in the concluding verse of this chapter, verse 22, he does not look beyond the immediate present. As we said, he does not refer to the resurrection. Taking a view consistent with the limits of human life and leaving aside his knowledge that God will one day demand an accounting, he counsels his readers, there is nothing better.
Sorry.
Right?
Unpredictable life.
Have to wave our arms around a bit more. There is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his heritage. But in the next chapter, chapter 4, Solomon returns to the conclusion of this live for today attitude and finds it wanting. Then I returned and considered all the oppression that is done under the sun. Yes, people's lives are not lived in isolation. People form part of a wider society and are ruled by a government. But suppose that government is an oppressive tyranny that robs him of the fruits of his labour. Where then is his heritage and with it any enjoyment of life? And look, the tears of the oppressed, but they have no comforter. On the side of their oppressors there was power, but they have no comforter. Solomon reviewed all the oppression under the sun. He saw the voiceless, powerless, and vulnerable poor of all ages, from the impoverished tenants of a greedy landowner to the persecuted subjects of a ruthless tyrant. We can see, even in our modern world, I'm sure, plenty of examples of that. He saw how hopeless their situation was, with no one to help or even listen to them, crushed by the power and influence of their oppressors, with no hope of redress or justice. What possible point was there to their lives? The dead were better off than them. Indeed, if this is all human society could produce for its masses, better not to be born into this evil world. Verse 2, therefore I praise the dead who are already dead, more than the living who are still alive. Yet better than both is he who has never existed, who has not seen the evil work that is done under the sun. But even those who do escape from this grinding oppression, their successes come with drawbacks, verse 4. Again, I saw that for all toil and every skillful work, a man is envied by his neighbour. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. Their achievements and status become a source of envy, which can rob the worker of his pleasure. By contrast, the lazy fool brings himself to ruin, verse 5. He eats his own flesh. Both extremes are therefore to be avoided as they lead to futility. Rather, Solomon counsels a quiet life of moderation rather than wearing oneself out to chase the wind just to have two hands full. Better is a handful with quietness, verse 6, than both hands full together with toil and grasping for the wind. What indeed would Solomon make of the restless ambition that feeds the materialistic greed of so many of our contemporaries in this modern 21st century world? He then returns in verse 7 to consider the final of the three factors outlined in this chapter that limit human happiness, that can spoil the rejoicing of a man in his own works. Then I returned, and I saw vanity under the sun. There is one alone, without companion. He has neither son nor brother, yet there is no end to all his labours. Nor is his eye satisfied with riches, but he never asks, "For whom do I toil and deprive myself of good?" This also is a vanity and a grave misfortune. Loneliness is indeed a major problem in our modern Western society, with so many people forced by economic pressures into living far from their friends and families, a trend exacerbated by broken marriages and small nuclear families. But this phenomenon was obviously present in Solomon's day too. He considered the antithesis of contentment, the man or woman who not only has no heir to pass on his wealth to, but spends his life alone without any companions to share life with. He is so obsessed with accumulating wealth that he never takes a step back, never pauses to ask for what or whom is the purpose of all his toil and effort. I'm sure each of us can think of examples of this kind of meaninglessness amongst our work colleagues or neighbours that we've come across at some time in our lives. A vanity and a grave misfortune indeed. The next few verses, 9 to 12, go on to emphasise the disadvantages of the solitary life, with timeless illustrations from daily life of the benefit of companionship. Two can accomplish more work than one can singly. They can help one another in difficulties. They can keep warm if they need to spend a night in the open. And they feel more secure when together against threats. And still greater is the strength of three companions when their lives are intertwined in harmony. So to sum up what we have considered so far, Solomon has considered the factors beyond man's control that constrain his life. Starting with the greatest of these, time, he has passed on to consider other factors such as the pressures of society and government that can rob life of its satisfaction. Yet Solomon has concluded that mere material gain without human companionship is futile and empty. Life is greatly enriched and strengthened by friendship. Non-monetary gain, non-monetary rewards are just as important. Man, after all, is a social animal. He or she needs friends, companions, brothers, sisters to strengthen them and to encourage their walk through life. Following this sequence of thought, Solomon, in the last few verses of this chapter, turns to the top of the social order and finds that even the throne is subject to vanity and uncertainty and meaninglessness. His investigations leave no doubt of the superiority of wisdom over folly, verse 12. Better is a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who will be admonished no more. In Solomon's illustration, an obstinate old king, beyond learning, is swept from power by a young rival who has been kept in prison. The new monarch has evidently grown up in poverty, and this appears to have given him a better understanding of life in the real world that gains him a popular reputation. For he comes out of prison to be king, although he was born poor in his kingdom. I saw all the living who walk under the sun. They were with the second youth who stands in his place. The meaning of this verse 15 is somewhat obscure. Does the second youth refer to the usurper of the old king, or does this usurper himself get overthrown in a second revolution by another young pretender? Whatever, the moral of the story is that all the living who walk under the sun, in other words, the king's subjects, support the new king at first, but soon forget him. Verse 16, there was no end of all the people over whom he was made king, yet those who come afterward will not rejoice in him. how public fickleness has changed, how little rather public fickleness has changed in 3,000 years. It's interesting, isn't it, that as we face, this country faces an election in the next week, we think of the optimism with which a new government is welcomed in when it's first elected, and the honeymoon period when it can do no wrong. But then that soon fades, doesn't it? The people turn against the government because it is unable or unwilling to deliver on its promises. They become morally tarnished, perhaps. Their credibility lies in tatters. And we see that indeed, surely this also is vanity and grasping for the wind. They are unable to deliver, and the people turn against them. How vain indeed is human government. And so with that thought, we come to the end of our study tonight. As always, when studying Ecclesiastes, human life without God is shown to be pretty meaningless. It is only through the saving grace of our Heavenly Father that we can hope to make sense of our lives and have a hope for the future. So let us all heed the exhortation to make the best possible use of our time that remains to us before God calls us to account and in his mercy grants us the great gift of immortality and a place in his kingdom.